Hello, friends. Today is May the 7th here in Finland, and it's about 11:24 p.m. Actually, I started this process a little bit earlier, trying to get the correct astrological time, but pretty well going with whatever came up. This Waysak has been for many of us, and for me, a very powerful experience. We're still in the midst of it, of course. And certain thoughts have come to me, thoughts that I would like to share with you in a way that is perhaps a little bit spontaneous, without too much logical preparation. For so many years, the whole question of identification has been very much on my mind. This is a thought which goes together with thoughts concerning isolated unity, unity itself, synthesis, wholeness, oneness. Many of these words related to what we all consider to be an ultimate type of realization, which occurs at that unfoldment which we human beings call the enlightenment, the illumination, the Satori, and there are many stages of all of these. Probably the first of them, the first truly significant one, occurring at the time of the third degree, which DK has set for us as an objective, although many of us must first pass through the second degree, which will assure sufficient emotional tranquility and cleansing, and will prepare the orientation of the desire nature so that the aspirant, the disciple, can no longer be deflected. But there is no question that Master DK is involved in the training of aspirants for the first, second, and third initiations, and that the rules that we try to follow, the 14 rules for applicants, offer the method for the individual, not so much the group, but for the individual to achieve the first three initiations. It's not so much about initiation that I wish to speak. I wish to speak more about those states of consciousness which are required for the individual to establish himself as initiate and thereby open the door to the possibility of actually being initiated. So in a way, what I have to discuss are certain generalities which, if they can be absorbed and made real to the consciousness, much progress toward these desired ends will be made. You know, I was sitting here in our temple in Finland, the Temple of Silence, and it has been, I think, for me and for Tuya, a very rewarding and also exhausting time. We've just come from the 26th International USRSRI Conference. It's just very demanding time, night after night. And so I think we're somewhat in a state of exhaustion. I certainly was today. But then later, you know, following all of our WASAC activities here, I went into the temple by myself and I just sat down and tried to think about what was most important. There are so many things to which a person could apply himself or herself, so many things, all of them important in a way, and so everybody has to search for that which is most important to himself particularly. And for me, it is to come closer to the realization of unity, oneness, isolated unity, being, identification with being and as being. You know how some of you who have read Discipleship in the New Age, both volumes, know how D.K. Isolated certain keynotes for his disciples. He observed their lives and said, these are keynotes for you. Keynotes which should be fulfilled, somehow expressed. Some were lofty, some were mundane. And in the Moria Federation work, I encourage our students and the faculty members to determine for themselves, since Master DK is not immediately available to do that for all of us, to determine for themselves what might be the keynotes for their life, whether three or four or so. You know, I've wrestled with this idea a great deal in my own case, and I find that identification is for me a major keynote. Something that somehow, ever since I met my very first teacher, Andrew McIver, born in Scotland with six planets in Pisces and Leo rising, ever since I met him and I discovered the value through his presence of identification. He knew who he was, and his identification with the whole was complete, as one might expect with such powerful Pisces and the higher properties or qualities of Leo operative. I think whatever life he touched changed for the better, and certainly mine was among them. So I've held in my heart and mind his influence concerning the power of identification. I don't really think he called it that, but when he used the word I, it wasn't a personal I. It was that larger being in whom we live and move and have our being, which for practical purposes we could call at this time the planetary logos, although naturally there are many levels of that one in whom we live and move and have our being, and certainly levels that go far beyond the scope of our planetary logos, even though he, the divine hermaphrodite, is unfathomable to us at our present stage of understanding. So ever since I met him, on my way, of course, forthright fashion to a dance rehearsal where I was supposed to put in an appearance, and did not, I kind of veered off, and that decision not to attend that dance rehearsal, I was a member of an Israeli dance troupe, liked it a lot, but decided this was more important. I'd been observing this man for months before I decided that I would speak with him. He was at the University of Michigan, where I was a student in all kinds of things. There was a great crossroads in front of magnificent, monstrous library. And we call this crossroads the diagonal, because a number of cross came together. The arms of the cross came together there. And he would sit on the diag, and well, I don't know. It looked like thinking, meditating, occasionally talking to people. So this one morning that I was off on my Sunday morning trip to my rehearsal, I deviated. I have to check the aspects of the time. I think some Uranus was in there. It was the best deviation I ever made in my life because it got me started at the age of 19 or 20. On this path from which I have never wavered, though I've made many mistakes. Anyway, I remember it was a kind of a sunny morning, even at that time of day, morning, and, you know, not yet really warm, not really yet spring. And he was sitting there, and I kind of came up near him. He just began talking, really. He just began talking. And there were these concrete benches. And they were surrounding the diag, and people would sit on these benches. And the first thing he said to me was about the stone in the bench. He said, the more resistance it offers, the hotter it gets. And he invoked the image of the sun, the presence of the sun. It was a sunny day. And I immediately got the idea that I had, there was no use resisting the divine, you know, because the heat would come and the changes would be made regardless of the resistance. One could only cause oneself more pain. It was time to accept the divine in my life. Well, over the next 70 years, huh? What did I say, 70? No. 7 years. But it seems like just about 70 now because I'm almost 70. I was his student, and I just met him occasionally, always bumping into each other, and we would talk, or rather, I would listen. That's how it was. He had a lot of first ray. I think a second ray soul and a first-ray personality. I would listen, and I listened carefully. And I learned about reincarnation, karma, law, most of all, about identification. Seeing the real thing before my eyes, seeing this, feeling this, of one who had achieved what I think I've struggled all my life to achieve, and know there are various gradations of it, and know I have not yet achieved certainly what I wish to achieve. But all my life has been spent dealing with this undercurrent, this substratum, this theme of identification, which, studying the Tibetan, I learned to recognize, and learn to recognize it by many names. So, you know, Andrew was for me the opening door. And, of course, encountering Madame Blavatsky, Theosophy, Masonry, and the Blue Books, Master Joao Kuhl, just some years later, gave me the rationale for all that I had experienced with Andrew in a immediate sense. So, you know, I dedicated my big book to him, and of course also the Master DK and the Great Ones, because it was a book about identification, the infinitization of selfhood, although probably a very third-ray approach to a first-ray subject, was essentially all about identification and overcoming the illusion of separateness. It was based upon "Thou art that." Tatsvam Asi, a great statement from the Upanishads, which contains the essence of all books on these matters. And though I wrote extensively on the subject and used my differentiating mind to see all the ins and outs of time and space as I could understand it at that time, and hopefully I understand a bit more now, I realize that it's the straight knowledge of identification which is the most important to all of us. We can write 10,000 words or read 10,000 words or millions of words and yet be not especially closer to the true experience of the One, or what I've been calling the All-Pervading One, the APO, the All-Pervading One, which I think of here at Waysack as Sanat Kumara, the sense of the All-Pervading One being present in the eyes of the Masters, through the Masters. That's one of the ways I think I experience it. I look at their images, some of them good, some of them maybe a little bit not so accurate, at least of their physical vehicle. But I sense through their eyes that presence that is behind and within all of them, and really is them, and they are it. I sense this presence present in every atom and subatomic particle of our planetary manifestation, in every creature, in every human being. They are all but one thing. They have emerged out of the light that He is, the substantial light that is His, and from it they come and to it they return, and that makes of us really all one being in one presence. Though He Himself is a presence, a lesser presence within a greater presence, and on it goes. There is but one presence in all of this cosmos, one universal logos, one being of the present cosmos, with one consciousness and one creative intelligence, with one will and one state of love, attraction, and desire. And all the many movements are but one movement. I've become quite intent these days on making realizations of this nature as intense as possible, and trying to find my own way. Who knows whether it will be successful, but try to find my own way to help others do the same, if they find it important for them. I've spent many years of my life studying, meditating, maybe more study even than meditation. And I'm pretty meticulous type, and seek to know what I consider to be all the facts, although others wouldn't consider them to be facts. For me, revealing the sixth ray here, but if Master DK has said it, it's a fact. At least I have the faith that it is so. So collecting all these many facts, these nuggets of esoteric knowledge, and comparing them, combining them, relating them, seeing the patterns that they make, using them to penetrate further into facts which have not yet been stated as facts, but which are implicit, or maybe I should say, which are implicate within the worldview that Master Decay and the other masters are presenting. So I've collected many, many facts. You know, just I have references running over in this computer that I call AAB extracts, and many other facts from other sources as well, trying to put them all together with what I consider to be the third aspect of the second ray, the ray of the occultist, the detailed unity and the meticulous entirety of that particular third aspect of the second ray. I tried to put all these things together into a unified worldview, and I'm far from it. But beneath all of this combining things into a divine pattern, which hopefully will reflect mosaically the true archetypal divine pattern, which is their model, something even more important begins to assert itself, and that is the need for the realization of isolated unity, the need for the realization of the one substanding thing, the one substance, which is it all. You know, Spinoza, in his definitions, his six preliminary definitions, which is sometime I'd like to read, they're so brilliant, you know. Spinoza was identified as a member of hierarchy, or at least under that hierarchical vibration. He defines God, and I think as the infinity of infinities. I took a lot of inspiration from that. But for him, substance, is not stuff, you know, it's God. It's God itself, the one substanding being. Irreducible being is substance. And beneath all these particles of knowledge, which I seem to love to collect, comes the substance, and the thought of the substance, and the realization of the supremacy of the substance, quite apart from any factual formulations which may emerge from the substance. That has begun to seem to me, it really has for years, but you know, now even more impressively, as the most important, somehow to help us excuse me, help us all participate within in this substance, and even at a further stage of identification as this substance. You know, there is what I call identification with, which still implies a duality, and identification as, which suggests the merging of the identifier with that with which he must identify. The two are one and not separate things at all. I think that's the state for us to achieve. Well, when you think about Master DK's works, he deals a lot with many practical issues that are of value to evolving human beings and to spiritual human beings, especially who are evolving, and he deals with the nitty-gritty of life and all the different areas of human development. And all of these are most necessary and are, I think, the foundation for many divine approaches to be undertaken in the next centuries and for the fields of human endeavor and knowledge which must be developed. I think he's set us all on the right track, whether it's in politics or education, in psychology, in science, in religion, in economics. in the area of the clarification of consciousness. In so many ways, he set us on the right track, you know, giving us the science of the seven rays, the ray language, the science of esoteric astrology, tremendous material on the chakras, on all their levels, on their interrelationships. We have so much. And maybe only in a few places does he actually get into some of the higher abstract issues which relate to the factor of synthesis. He talks about synthesis quite a bit. He gives us some of the old commentary and old stanzas which suggest synthesis. He deals with what he considers to be an inadequate term. He calls it isolated unity. In certain places, he deals with the unification which must occur in consciousness, the ability to see with the unified eye, the blue eye, the eye of Shiva, rather than with the two eyes which convey dualistic perception. He takes us beyond duality, certainly, in many, many hints, and in some very powerful objective statements, though I think the majority of his work has to deal with the spiritual practicalities. I'm looking here, you know, you've been seeing it, I'm just a little picture up there in the corner. This is the third formula of six formulas which we find in Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2, right around page 284, 285. And he says, what does he say here? It's kind of the foundation of all philosophy. Let's look at it. Let's read what he has to say. Because with this particular section from the old commentary and with an ancient Atlantean section, let's kind of consider the basis for my thought is established. This third formula concerns time and the consciousness of the spiritual man who is unaware of separation, of divisions in time and space, or of the spell of the great illusion, a spell under which we all labor, even unto the ninth initiation. And then who is to say that the universe itself is not a great illusion when compared to the ultimate abstraction of irreducible be-ness, as opposed to a being that has no possibility of being defined. So it must be be-ness rather than a being, although some might call it pure being. Well, anyway, the kind of consciousness that we're talking about here is unaware of separation. Remember that Master D.K. does discuss the great heresy of separateness, the only one true heresy. Heresies have been considered to be modes of thought which deviate from particular concrete mental formulations. And of course, the narrow, limited concrete mind is involved here. And it has no possibility of arriving at truth, and yet it persecutes those who hold on to other formulations of truth. Well, anyway, DK sweeps all of these conventional definitions of heresy aside. And for him, the one heresy is the heresy of separateness. Well, if we can operate as the spiritual man, and I presume this to be the man who can be focused within his causal body or even beyond, as within the higher part of the higher mental plane, namely the abstract mind, and even better in the Buddhic field, and even better in the atmic field, well then, he is then the spiritual man. And he has that type of consciousness in which he is unaware of separation, division, and even of time and space as limitations. This third formula deals with the fact of immortality and with the unshatterable continuity of consciousness and life. Well, there is no moment in which life, in essence, ceases. And DK seems to suggest that there is no ultimate moment of unconsciousness either. In the lower extensions of our consciousness, we may become temporarily unconscious as we make transitions to higher and lower areas within the field of universal consciousness, but it is impossible for that which consciousness is to cease being what it is. Unconsciousness is not possible, ultimately, although that Madame Blavatsky sometimes said that the great Venus is unconscious, but I think that would be a privation that we could not ascribe to it, because in it are all possibilities and no privation of possibility. So even though it would be a kind of consciousness that we, completely unfathomable, I suppose, in a way, even by the highest, by the universal logos himself, even though it would become unfathomable, something which suggests continuity of awareness, even of itself, must exist. In my Infinity book, I've dealt with this subject and the merging of consciousness being within this ultimate state. But anyway, it deals with the fact of immortality and with the unshatterable continuity of consciousness and life. And this means that even when the universe disappears, as it has forever cyclically, though Venus has never disappeared, there persists this unshatterable continuity of consciousness and life. It is this formula which at the third initiation produces the transfiguration which comes when the eternal now is realized, and when the continuity of awareness and of identity is seen as an aspect of being. Here the second aspect, awareness, and the first aspect, identity, are merged in the fact of being. I've often said that we are a point of being consciousness. If we look for that which we are within these lower worlds where we must manifest as a point, it is a point of being consciousness in which there is innate intelligence, just to complete the Trinity. This formula has been called by one of the masters, quote, the seed of all philosophies. And in that phrase, you might find light on the subject, provided you know what philosophy is. Well, philosophia, the love of wisdom, and I suppose there is no wisdom without knowing what being is and participating with full awareness in that being as an identity which is merged with that being and merged as that being. So wisdom ever is, and the various knowledges come and go, but they can all be derived from a fundamental wisdom which I think is the perspective of any given hierarch on his system. So the ultimate system is the many-layered cosmos itself, and it is the perspective of the universal logos, the one and only logos at any one time, who contains within itself all these levels of cosmos, and they are extensions of itself, externalizations of that one being. So the seed of all philosophies, and I guess no wonder it appeals to me so much, you know, as I think I love philosophy. I think I do. I don't know how well I do in a normal academic philosophy class. I was once warned away from it because it seemed that I believed too much in unsubstantiated matters, such as God, being, reality, and the hierarchy as representatives of those. Well, you can't deal rationally with all of those factors, at least in what the academic philosophers call a rational approach. The leap of faith, unfortunately, in my case, had already been made. So there was no question in my mind about the reality of these things, and dealing with the tedious matter of somehow proving the existence of God or the existence of a foundational reality did not seem worth the effort. Though I think for those who are purely on the third ray and who maybe do not wish to make or cannot find it within themselves to make such a leap of faith, I think it is a necessary approach and no doubt leads to many clarifications about the errors which we make as we think about these matters. So to the initiate who uses this formula, creating the necessary sounds and enunciating the ancient words in due place, and these, he says, I may not give you. The following six thoughts are emphasized in his consciousness. These six thoughts will give you the intent of the formula as clearly as is possible, at least as clearly as is possible to us now. It is not possible to convey to you the true beauty of the concepts. Ah. Wow. I've been invisible. All right. Now I'm not. Oh my, I've been invisible in the upper left-hand corner, and so has everything I've been reading been invisible. But now, it is visible. Well, I guess there is a, when dealing with these subjects, there is a good reason to begin with a state in which all form is blotted out. Blotting out all form, hiding all difference, blotting out all form. So I guess somehow a symbolically appropriate beginning. I guess I've been talking for about a half hour here, and there are many things to keep together. I've kind of missed the boat when it came to showing what I wanted to show, but here we are. You see what I've been reading from here. These are the words of the Tibetan, now visible on the screen. So DK may not give us the ancient sounds and the ancient words. Very old. Older, he says, than the stanzas of Xian. So it is not possible to convey to you the true beauty of the concepts, but if you will have in mind the thought of meaning as light on life, of cause as the breath of experience, and of being as the initiator of all that is, then some vision may come, some dream arise in your consciousness, and some power of accomplishment pour in. Well, each of those could truly be meditated upon. We do want to shed light on all the processes of life. Though by life, what does he mean here? The one originating essence? Or does he mean the normal processes that we perceive? Certainly meaning sheds light on the many processes in which we engage, but we want to go even deeper and consider that undefinable life and have some sense of what it may be. Cause sets things in motion, and the breath is related to the will which impels. The breath, in a way, is the prime mover. It is the breath of God which conveys the life, which causes the movement of all things, and the primary cause of all things. There are many things we do experience, but without the divine breath, none of them would come to pass. There would be no division, there would be no motion, there would be no relationship. So we look upon the very first aspect of the will, in a way, as the breath, the prime mover. But much needs to be pondered here. And of being as the initiator of all, being descends to manifest, he tells us in the second of the stanzas. Being descends to manifest, and from this pure, irreducible essence, all that we come to know originates. From being arises the breath. Its descent to manifest is, as it were, the breath which causes all experience. But you know, we could dwell for a month on any one of these statements. Then some vision may come, some dream arise in which your consciousness, a dream arise in your consciousness, and some power of accomplishment pour in. The masters use this formula when faced with death in some form or another, and these words must be used literally, because there's always a change of scene. Death is a change of scene. The consciousness which perceives can never be annihilated. But the scene can change, even if that changing scene is the annihilation of the entire universe, giving way to what? To a type of ultimate state, which I've called it the infinitescence. It is the essence, the ultimate essence, and it is irreducible and infinite in its nature. So even when the universe gives way to something infinitely greater than itself, there is but a change of scene, and that part of the infinitescence which is immersed in universe never fades away. It always has continuity, it always has been, it always will be, and we are that. Thou art that. We are the being, or the beingness, who never was born and never can die, but persists forever throughout all duration, beginningless and endless. So there are many deaths, and they are changes of consciousness, leaving behind one field of perception and the fading in of another field. He says he refers not to death as it may affect them, but to death as it affects God's created universe. Yes, he's talking about the large thing. Producing release or finality, or opening the door to new life and closing the door on a cycle of manifestation, a civilization or a race or nation. The masters get used to thinking in large terms. They have transcended their preoccupation with their individuality, which is simply to them now an instrument within the larger identity with which they are now identified. And on it goes, greater identifications lie before them. Excuse me. Well, you know, it's just scratching the surface, but the more we ponder on these matters, then perhaps, as DK says, some vision may come, some dream may arise in our consciousness, some power of accomplishment pour in. DK has told us that lives change primarily through reflection, perhaps not so much by outer action, although those actions do contribute. But he says, if you really want to know what love is, then reflect on love. And I'm sure the reflections required are very deep. So let us look at some of these a little. Here, therefore, are the six conditioning thoughts which the initiate holds in his consciousness when using the formula. A formula which is older than the stanzas of Tian. Well, he has given us Atlantean stanzas, and they, I presume, are also older than the stanzas of Tian. And now he gives us foundational philosophical stanzas, missing the notes and words, one day to be trumpeted forth, but giving us at least some meaning with which we can work. I've memorized these. I repeat them to myself fairly often. And I would recommend the same for you, because when they are learned by heart and they go into the system, they begin to mean more. They begin to become a part of you. So that, I think, is advisable. Well, maybe we will read them through just as they are first. And I think all through this kind of discussion on identification, which I feel prompted to offer, even though I feel unqualified to offer it, we will from time to time refer to these foundational statements, because they are so grand and so fundamental. So we begin with number one. God is. The Lord for A stands firm. Being exists alone. Naught else is. Time is. Being descends to manifest. Creation is. Then, time then and form agree. Being and time do not agree. Then the third. Unity is. The one between comes forth and knows both time and God. But time destroys that middle one, and only being is. Number four, space is. Time and space reverberate and veil the one who stands behind. Pure being is. Unknown and unafraid, untouched, for A, unchanged. Number five, God is. Time, space, the middle one, with form and process go. And yet for A, remain. Pure reason then suffices. Number six, being cries forth and says, he cannot translate what being says, death crumbles all, existence disappears, and yet for A remains, untouched, immutably the same. God is. Well, there's a whole treatise to be written on those six. Let's see what he says further about it, about these six. Each phrase out of the six has its own symbol at the close of each unit of thought, if I may call it that. Each one of these is then a unit of thought. These I may not give you, or the chords upon which the phrases go forth. I've tried to indicate one of the meanings of the formula, but have not given a translation or a paraphrase. Bear this in mind, and as you ponder these six sentences, try to give them an interpretation which will come to you from the world of meaning, producing a practical application. Well, that would be at least minimally the world of the soul. From the world of causes, producing an enlightened understanding. This idea of the world of causes not only relates to the causal body, but ultimately to the logoic plane, although I don't think he means that here. In a way, all the four cosmic ethers, our Buddhic, Atmic, Monadic, logoic planes of our cosmic physical plane, they are all causative with respect to the lower worlds, even as our four systemic ethers are causative to our dense systemic levels of gas, liquid, and solid density, although there is really no such thing, but it's a perception upon which materialism is based. And if you are far enough along from the world of being, producing inclusiveness, well, the world of being I have interpreted as existing on the monadic plane, which is one of the foremost archetypal planes, even though all the four levels of the cosmic ethers can be considered worlds of being, at least relatively to the dense physical nature of the planetary solar logos, namely the mental, astral, and physical etheric planes. But the world of being, where the archetypes in sevenfold form exist, is the monadic level, but even more deeply, I think we could call the logoic plane the world of being. These formulas have not to do with personalities or with souls in deep incarnation, presumably within the dense physical body of the planetary logos. You see, the causal body is still within the dense physical body of the solar logos, but not within the dense physical body of the planetary logos. These formulas have not to do with personalities or with souls in deep incarnation identified with form in the three worlds. They concern world movement, great and universal developments, perhaps developments within our local universe, our solar system, and human progress as a whole towards the divine. You cannot yet think in those terms, he says, but you can at least attempt to do so and grow thereby. So we are flexing our identificatory muscles. We're trying to learn how to see things in great wholes and how to identify as reality whatever stratum of reality we can touch, because there are ever deepening strata of reality. So, well, we are just about there. Maybe what I should do is take up this further discussion of this. I'm just letting this unfold as it comes, you know. As I was meditating in the temple, it came to me that finally I have to do something a little more direct about discussing the unity, the oneness, even the synthesis in which we live and which we ultimately are. So this is, in true Aries manner, a launching into it just shortly after getting the idea, even to the point where for the first half, I left out all images whatsoever. But somehow I'm willing to come to an accommodation with that error, thinking that it does reveal something of the inner nature of the process, which is formless, which relates to the hiding of all difference and the blotting out of all form. I think what I'll do now is just we'll go to the great invocation, and we will close with that, and then I'll continue with these thoughts, these six great thoughts, and then perhaps lead into this initiatory mantram, which was proclaimed in Atlantean times, which has fallen out of use but is still very, very potent. Then get into a few of my own thoughts about the matter, thoughts which have been coming to me about the all-pervading one, the all-pervading presence, that being which includes all our earthly lives and is somehow resplendently revealed within the presence and countenance of the Masters of the Wisdom. That's something with which we should learn to identify, although it will take a long time to do so. It should be an objective. I think that perhaps from the time of the period surrounding the second initiation and onward, accented at the third and intensified beyond, something about the nature of identification in relative purity can be pursued. And I think it behooves us to make the attempt. So here is the great invocation. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Oh. Oh. Okay, friends, we will move on shortly to identification number two and figure out what to call these very shortly. So we will proceed with the six stanzas in a little while.